Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In a public health crisis, you'd expect that science-based decisions would be the way to deal with the spread of a deadly virus. Unfortunately, that is not always the case. We've seen public outbursts and fits of rage that are happening in public meetings. There are protests with assault rifles and politicians attacking public health experts. Although of these public health rules requiring masks and business shutdowns are broadly popular with the public, a vocal minority opposes them, and that is sometimes fueled by politics. Is there a way to dial this back? How is this impacting policy making and public health outcomes? We're talking about the politics of public health in a pandemic. We're joined by Lori Trumell Freeman, the chief executive for the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Lori, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
Also with us is Christopher Kulasha, research analyst with the Child Health Policy Program at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. Christopher, good to have you today.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And joining us also is Lauren Weber, reporter with the Kaiser Health News. And Lauren, good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lori, if you could tell us, looking at this from the perspective of the National Association of County and City Health Officials, we have these leaders, these directors of health departments who are trying to lead the way to help people keep people safe during the pandemic. What kind of additional stress are they under right now because of of what's happening with politics?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of stress just from having to respond to the pandemic on the ground and in the community. And these public health officials are well-versed in community politics and are usually quite able to hold their own. But during this pandemic, across the country, what we're seeing are that public health officials and the staff that support them are actually being, in some cases, physically threatened, verbally threatened, politically scapegoated, for simply trying to issue public health measures to help protect us all. So that's sort of what's going on the ground. And the politicization of it is due to people really opposing the measures to halt the virus, including stay-at-home orders, wearing masks, contact tracing, things that are seen as necessary to help stop the spread, but are considered by others as something that is inhibiting their own ability to move about and do the things they're used to doing. They're considering a threat to their freedom.
And that's an interesting take that we hear frequently, that it's a threat to their freedom, but that seems to be a very fluid line of logic, because there are other threats to their freedom which don't seem to be a concern. And you wonder where this comes from, and if it's actually a threat to their freedom, how much. Christopher Kulasha, with a PhD, research analyst at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, you focus on child health policy programs. But when you do that, do you have to think about the human science, the behavioral science, about how policies are actually going to be received by the public?
You absolutely do. And we have to consider as well, not even just the freedom aspect of it, but a lot of people also felt that, you know, not everybody is able to work from home, right, or be able to stay at home through this pandemic. So there was a lot of concern from people that they wouldn't be able to continue on, of course, their livelihood, and wouldn't be able to go on to work and be able to have an income to be able to, you know, secure their family's position. So with that being said, you know, there haven't been really consistent or been quite a few mixed messages about what policymakers, of course, are willing to do to make sure that doesn't happen while they're following social distancing guidelines. And with that being said, too, you know, there were a lot of inconsistencies as well at the very beginning of the pandemic as well. And now as the science has caught up, we now have more of this consensus building as to what we should be doing in order to keep people safe. However, when, you know, we were at the very beginning and there was some consideration about whether or not masks were going to be working or whether or not social distancing was really going to be working, that put a lot of doubt in people's minds, unfortunately, and they haven't been really catching up to what researchers have been saying about what would be the best way to keep the pandemic down.
So you talked about inconsistencies, and when you mentioned that, I can't stop but think about this Dallas hair salon owner, Shelley Luther, who in May they were ordered closed because of the crackdown and trying to respond to the coronavirus. And then she refused to close. She reopened back up. And when she was refused to continue, you know, she kept cutting hair. And she was sentenced to jail for that. The local politicians in Texas, including the governor, Greg Abbott, and the attorney general and others, Ted Cruz, the senator, came to her defense. Dan Patrick, our lieutenant governor, offered to pay her fine and serve her sentence himself. So, I mean, these politicians were undercutting the rules that they had put in place, Christopher.
Right. And you're exactly correct with that. And we also have to be, though, sensitive, too, to the policymakers themselves in some cases, because they're, of course, responding to their voters and they're responding to those that are closest to them. So they're constantly having to balance out, right, the voters that put them in office and also the you know, greater health of the state. And we've been noticing that trend, you know, as time is going on, there's more and more policymakers that are saying, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, that we do need to be wearing masks, but they did kind of unfortunately undercut their message by taking some of these steps. Now, that I should mention too, that the consensus isn't reaching everybody. Of course, you know, we have Governor Kemp in Georgia, who recently barred local governments from being able to put down mask orders, and is having a bit of a conflict with the mayor of Atlanta. And even seeing Donald Trump now at certain times wearing a mask. But however, yes, the messages really didn't do very much, unfortunately, to build that consensus, particularly in the Republican base.
But Christopher, isn't it, here we are 4, 5 months, 6 months into this crisis, and we're still having this debate about whether or not to wear a mask? I mean, shouldn't we be beyond that? I mean, this hasn't the science finally established that where if everyone, and we've seen the head of the CDC say, if everyone would wear a mask, we could get this under control in 5 weeks?
Yes, and I do think so, absolutely. I do think that the results in the science are very much so consistent. In fact, I mean, we're sort of seeing this in real time. The areas, locations, nations that are using masks are seeing either a decline in the number of cases or the number of cases are stable. But with that being said, I do think, too, we have to think about another thing when it comes to the political aspect of this. And it also comes down to electoral politics.
All right, we'll talk more about that when we come back, because that presidential election is getting closer and closer every day, and that's certainly going to become a bigger part of this conversation. If you want to join our conversation as we talk about the politics of public health in this pandemic, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. And you can hear how fired up people are about hearing that they have to wear a mask to go into a store. This type of activity is happening all over America. It's unfortunate that people who are working at grocery stores are having to deal with this type of attitude and hear this type of language being thrown in their face. But it's even worse for people who work in the public health care industry. People who help public health officials, they're getting it in meetings. They're being shouted at also by elected officials. Why is public health become such a political hot potato? We're talking about that this hour, and you can join in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Lauren Weber is a reporter for Kaiser Health News. Lauren, how bad is it, really?
You know, here we are. We're about 6 months into the pandemic, and it's pretty bad for our public health workers on the ground. Let me start with a little bit of background context for you. I mean, these are folks who, since 2008, 38,000 of public health worker jobs have disappeared. So these are people that are working around the clock normally before you throw in a pandemic. Now you throw in a pandemic that's been politicized. And since April, 35 public health leaders have left their jobs across 17 states. Four of them were actually in Texas, in San Antonio, Laredo, Waco, and I can't remember off the top of my head. But they have left their jobs because they have either been called out on social media, their addresses have been leaked to the press, people have sent in emails saying they're going to start a civil war, that they're frustrated with them for making them wear masks or for not monitoring their neighbors wearing masks enough. It is a crisis of leadership among our public health workforce who has been confronted with a pandemic and vitriol that they have not seen. And truly, it is, you know, Lori herself, who's also on this program, said to me, it's quite alarming. You know, this is an exodus like we've never seen before. When it comes to public health workers, they typically just do not leave like this.
Let's go to our callers. We have a Max on the line. The number is 833-877-8255. Max, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I think that it's a shame that, you know, doing something as simple as wearing a mask to help to protect the health of people in this country has become politicized. And it starts with the incompetency at the top for his own political reasons, he is undercutting his own health officials. And what's sad about it is that come November, 23% of the population is still going to try to vote this man in office. I stand behind our health officials, and I hope they continue to push out the information that we need to keep our families safe. Thanks.
Max, thank you for the call. Anytime public health issues become part of private life, we're going to have questions of politics. We see that in things like vaccines and putting fluoride in the water and all sorts of stuff. This is so politics and public health, it's not necessarily brand new. Christopher, can you address that?
Sure, absolutely. So as we have, you know, as we've seen, of course, you know, throughout the course of the history of the United States, that people get, of course, very wary when it comes to any sort of either government mandate or any sort of public push in order to sort of say, you know, how people's health should be. So particularly when it comes, of course, to vaccines, right? Vaccines have been very well, you know, proven to be an excellent decision for the health, that they keep, you know, diseases from spreading. However, there's this idea of, you know, either individual liberty or individual responsibility that comes up within certain portions of the public that are saying that, hey, you know, it's not for the government to be telling me what to do with this, that this is a personal health decision. But however, of course, that creates, you know, collective action problems, right? Because it requires a large number of individuals to be able to have buy-in for these certain policies to be able to work. And it can be, of course, extraordinarily difficult to be able to change people's minds on that or to be able to convince them that these guidelines or that these particular ways to go are the correct ways to go. people end up, they sort of reinforce their ideas and their notions as time goes on, and they end up becoming more and more solidified and polarized and aren't willing to, unfortunately, take the steps necessary to be able to protect the people as a whole.
Sure, and scientists are not really schooled. They're trained, they're disciplined in not speaking in absolutes, and they are not really able to match the rhetoric of people who are not concerned with validity and integrity of science. And that becomes, doesn't play well in the public square sometimes.
And I do think, though, that at least one thing that I hope happens after COVID-19, after the pandemic is over, that we're able to bridge the gap between policymakers and scientists so that we're able to see, one, of course, so that this doesn't happen again and that we're able to respond much better to a future pandemic as well. But even with all different forms of public policy, that we're able to rely much more on evidence-based policymaking. Because, of course, you know, if you're using data, if you're using analyses to be able to guide the decisions of either the legislator, city council, or Congress, you are most likely to end up with better policy outcomes.
Okay. I'm going to play a voicemail, and this is from Michael.
This is Michael. The scientists are currently being erroneously presented as all-knowing and all-good people. In reality, they are just like anybody else, police, presidents, even lawyers. Remember presidents and lawyers by the name of President Nixon and President Clinton. The citizen must be alert to deception and bias in all presentations, including scientific presentations. Thank you very much.
Laurie Trommel Freeman, Chief Executive of the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Michael, you know, we've heard this observation coming from some elected officials saying that people like Tony Fauci, that they're not flawless, that they can make mistakes and that they have bias as well. And this seems to be a line of a way to undermine our public health officials. So is that something that, I mean, how do you respond to something along those lines?
You know, it's very challenging when you have a new disease because, as Christopher was saying, the science that as we're learning about the disease, what causes the disease, what the spread, how the spread of the disease happens, the symptoms, all of that we're learning as we go. And so the science is not infallible. It has to grow as we learn more about the disease. So there are likely to be times when guidance changes, when public information changes as we learn more and more about a disease. And I don't think that means we should question science in general, but we in public health also need to do a better job of explaining to the citizens in our community why things are changing, why guidance is changing, why we're seeing something different than we started out with, and what precipitated that change as we learn more about the disease. So I think there's a balance here between understanding that the science and data have to inform what we're doing here, but that it can and will change because this is something new that we don't know everything about, and we're learning about it as we go.
Laurie, do these county and city health officials, they have to be, they're focused on outcomes. They want to get the numbers down. They want to save lives. They want to limit the spread of the virus. And therefore, they realize, I imagine, that it's better for them not to shame people and call them out and say, you know, you people, you know, you have to do this. They have to figure out a way to, they have to sugarcoat things. But in the political back and forth, that sugarcoating often comes off as unsure and not as forceful as opposition, who's claiming that masks are killing them, that mask, I'm breathing my own air, that a mask will activate the virus that's already in my body. And so how do local, city, and county officials, how do they combat misinformation, outright lies, and total ignorance in a way that doesn't turn off the public?
Well, first, they can't give up. They have to stick with this and understand that we're in this for the long game. In order to get public trust and gain and gather public trust and maintain that trust, you have to be honest. You have to be working in your community. You can't have orders coming from way above, state, federal level without having really professionals deeply embedded in the community, understand the needs and of the community, but also understand the vulnerabilities of the community so that messaging can be tailored to those communities. And it's not a one-time effort. The whole basis of public health is based on the fact that over centuries of time, when we learned that we could learn more about controlling disease by understanding the science and data behind it, that the second important, equally important aspect of that is that we have to improve the growth of public acceptance that disease control is a possibility and a public responsibility. So ensuring that the public understands all aspects of this and what their own personal social commitment is to mitigating disease in the community, we all have a responsibility here. And with that, we have to continue to educate and do as many public campaigns as possible on educating everyone about the disease and what role they have in helping to stop it.
And Lauren Weber with Kaiser Health News, the partisan divide, how did this nonpartisan issue, how is it playing in this hyperpartisan era?
What do you mean exactly by that?
It seems like the Democrats have one, their talking points, and the Republicans have their talking points. One seems to be more in favor of science-based decisions, and then the Republicans are saying that they're using the coronavirus in order to hurt Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I wake up every day and wish that the pandemic had not happened in an election year, I can tell you that. But I do think that you are seeing divisions, obviously, along party lines on how, when you look at polling, how people are reacting, whether they feel comfortable wearing a mask, whether they feel better about social distancing. You know, consistently, when you look at polling along party lines, you see different reactions. As we come to more of a consensus on the science, as Lori was talking about, and as public health workers maybe work to refine that message and maybe reach across to get to these folks, we'll see some differences. But at the end of the day, in general, as you stated previously on this program, almost everything when it comes to public health and interacting with your day-to-day is going to be politicized. And we're seeing that play out at the federal, state, and local level right now.
Have an email from Joanne. I'm so frustrated that our governor and his administration followed the lead of Donald Trump and allowed this disease to ravage our state because they didn't have the courage to stand up to the economic interest and science deniers in their party. We're talking about politics and public health, what's happening in the pandemic. How can we dial this back? Is it possible to dial this back and get more people to put politics aside and start thinking about what can we do to deal with what we know works? We do know that wearing a mask works. We do know that social distancing works. We do know that, unfortunately, and we know it's tough economically, that it's going to have shutdowns will work, and it will limit the spread of the disease. And it is real. It is not a hoax. And those myths continue to be spread. How do we deal with that in a way that is not going to hit those hot buttons that people react to and then shut down the conversation? We don't want that. We want to continue the conversation. And we're going to do that when we come back. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Stay with us.
The coronavirus pandemic has thrown the asylum process into disarray. Migrants who could have had a legitimate claim are being expelled in the name of public health.
They have been basically pushed away from the United States with no process whatsoever.
Next time on Fronteras, we investigate expulsions as witnessed on the Texas-Mexico border and Mexico City. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the politics of the pandemic and what's happening with public health policy making, our concerns about voting base and about donors. Is that driving how these decisions are made about whether or not the state of Texas will allow counties to require wearing a mask and allow counties to make better decisions that will limit the spread of the disease? Or will we continue to have recommendations that don't seem to be working, as we've seen the number of deaths from COVID in Texas continue to climb? If you want to join the conversation, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's get Nick on the air. Nick's called in. Hey, Nick, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi there, Dave. Thank you very much for having me. It was just a quick comment that I wanted to make, and in regards specifically to the audio clip that you played at the very beginning of the newscast, where that guy was giving a lot of backlash to the grocery store worker who was trying to tell him to put on a mask, and he was just coming off at him. The idea, whenever I hear audio like that from or see examples of that, it really makes me feel gross inside, because those kind of people who have that mindset, it really feels like it's a type of selfish apathy, right? Like they don't care about the fact, they don't care about it until it actually affects them. And it's also that selfish apathy mixed with the idea that I don't want to be told what to do, right? And the governors who are asking their constituents to wear masks, recommending it and not mandating it the way they should, are just feeding into that feeling of from their constituents that don't want to wear masks because it inconveniences them. It's kind of like a snake eating its own tail there. They don't want to make their constituents mad, so they recommend it as opposed to mandating it, and the constituents are buying into it because of the fact that it doesn't go in with their selfish apathy. And that was my comment on that. Thank you, Dave.
Well, Nick, thank you for calling in with that. Christopher Kulasha, a PhD research analyst at the Child Health Policy Program at Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. We've had other healthcare issues, scares in the United States. Under Obama, we had the Ebola and also H1N1, another very threatening pandemic to the United States. We never reached this level. Was that because decisions were made at the top to prevent it from getting this bad?
I think there's a bit of public policy, of course, but just very basically, we're dealing with a very different virus. We're dealing with a virus that can spread while people are asymptomatic, that is able to move very easily from person to person, that, of course, is a respiratory illness. This is sort of like what Dr. Fauci was saying was like his worst case scenario or his nightmare scenario. When you have, viruses like Ebola, for example, Ebola didn't spread very well relative to other viruses. So I do think it's in part public policy, but I think it's just sort of the nature of the virus itself that made it much more difficult to contain and control.
Lauren Weber, reporter for Kaiser Health News, though we didn't have an administration that ordered the production of the PPE that we needed at the beginning of this. We had the administration pitting states against states, fighting for the PPE that was available. Also, the Commerce Department sending out letters to domestic PPP providers telling them to sell it to China when we could have been holding it for domestic use. Were all sorts of decisions that were made in the White House that didn't really take this seriously from the very beginning. And so is pointing that out a political act as a reporter for Kaiser Health News? If you report on these things, do you get blowback saying, well, you're just being partisan?
I mean, as a reporter, it's your job to report the facts. So I will say on the production, the reluctance to institute the Defense Production Act, my colleagues and I at Kaiser Health News wrote many stories about how nasopharyngeal swabs, for instance, were running short and how contracts were not having the DPA executed on them in other places. You know, I will say when it comes to the topic of PPE in particular, I think it's important to note that those shortages are still ongoing. In fact, they've never really ended. And I think you're seeing that, especially now in hotspots like Texas and Florida. So it's important to report on, you know, what the facts are on the ground and what public policy trickle-down effects are to create those facts.
Let's go to Barbara on the phones. Barbara, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, my comment is I'm all for mask wearing, but I really wish that our leaders, that when they have their daily news brief, even though they sit there whatever distance apart, that they would model the behavior that they want the people to observe. So they really should wear masks when they, you know, have their daily briefing, even though it's hard to talk like that, but they ask people to do that. And I see the reality of it downtown every day. You know, it's hard to put a mask on all day when you're out in the heat and stuff, but they should model it. Thank you.
Barbara, thank you for that call. We have a voicemail. This is an anonymous one.
Hello. I'm calling because I believe the corona pandemic has been overdone. The statistics show that there is about 7.8 billion people in the world and 615,000 deaths. That's less than 1%, far less than 1%, about a tenth of a percent of a chance that it could be fatal. Not to mention that tobacco kills almost three times more people worldwide than are infected, not fatal cases, but that are infected with the coronavirus. So just the United States alone, the tobacco industry kills about 500,000 people a year, a little under 500,000 people a year. The coronavirus is expected to, in the United States, take out 200,000 people this year. So I don't believe our priorities are straight. If you get infected and it does turn out to be fatal, I understand it's bad. We don't want that to happen. However, the statistics show that the way things are being handled is not going to be financially sound for the future if this keeps happening.
Lori Trumell Freeman, Chief Executive of the National Association of County and City Health Officials, comparing what's happening now with coronavirus to the number of deaths from tobacco. That's a true figure. I checked it out. We do have a lot of it is the number one cause of preventable deaths in the United States. Half a million people die a year to tobacco-related illnesses. But comparing that, does that make sense?
Not necessarily, because we're talking about an infectious disease versus, in many cases, a choice that somebody makes to perhaps smoke a cigarette or something else that could cause disease. So that's a purely preventable disease in terms of tobacco smoking. Whereas infection, it does not discriminate, and infectious disease can touch anyone at any time. And if you don't mitigate the spread, then, 200,000 is probably at the low end of what we would see if we did no mitigation efforts at all. So there is a difference in bringing that up as a comparison. And I understand this is an argument that many people make about the death rate and so forth. But when you have something spreading worldwide and you think about how often that happens and how often we have a pandemic, it's very rare. It's extremely rare. The last time is over 100 years ago. This is an impact to an entire population that, unless you take pure public health measures, is not going to stop, and more people will die or be infected.
Lauren Weber at Kaiser Health News. Does it seem like women are being attacked more? Women in the in this industry of county and city health officials. It seems like the level of attack and the veracity of it is at a different level.
I would agree with that. I mean, in general, about 70% of public health workers are women, so there are more in the field to be attacked. But that said, it seems that the vitriol aimed at them is just completely different and, frankly, completely out of line. I mean, I spoke with Emily Brown, who was a rural Colorado public health official who was eventually fired. But before that, on Facebook, someone posted, and from her community, you know, who didn't live that far from her, a photo of her and several other public health officials commenting on their weight. And someone commented saying that in the old days, they would string them from trees. That's how we'd handle it. And, you know, other horrible, horrible things in the community. And that kind of attack, those kind of pointed, you know, almost, you know, indications of violence seem to be more headed towards the female officials that we have been profiling. And I will add too, you know, it's not just Colorado. You have Amy Acton in Ohio, who armed protesters showed up at her house. She ended up resigning. You have Nicole Quick, who is a commissioner in Colorado, who ended up resigning after her address and her boyfriend's name were read aloud at a town hall meeting. I mean, these are all women who have been very adversely impacted through their public health role.
Also, you calling it the China virus, which we heard from Donald Trump yesterday, never called it COVID-19 or coronavirus, always just the China virus. So it seems that these attacks seem to prey upon existing bigoted views, Lauren?
I mean, I would say that the use of the word China virus is an intention to deflect blame, right? I mean, that's it's to imply that the virus, which it did come from China, but it's to, you know, redirect kind of the irritation that is being aimed at the Trump administration for its handling of the pandemic to potentially another vessel. And I believe that that is most likely what's behind labeling it that way.
We're going to continue our conversation talking about politics, public health, and pandemic. How has this hyper states of partisanship hurt efforts for contact tracing and dealing with trying to limit the spread of the coronavirus? We'll talk about that when we come back from the break. Also, you can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The COVID-19 numbers are getting worse and worse by the day. The number of cases, the number of hospitalizations, and the number of deaths. How tied are these terrible outcomes to politics? If we're able to get politics out of this and just focus on trying to deal with this in a scientific way, is that possible? And what, do we have better results? Could we be able to get the virus contained and get our economy open sooner? If you have a question or comment, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Christopher Kulasha, a PhD research analyst with the Child Health Policy Program at Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. Contact tracing, being able to figure out where someone got the virus from, how does that work, and how has this environment made that more difficult?
So there are different ways that you can do it. So there's places like Ireland, which has been using or trying to use an app, a phone app, which has been relatively successful. They were able to get quite a few people within their population to download the app. There's also, of course, just being able to hire contract tracers and being able to ask individuals, you know, where are they, where do they get the virus from, or where do they think they got the virus from. But that being said, you know, we have, particularly in the United States, a lot of practical issues with that. One, of course, just being that the spread right now is so out of control that contact tracing is just going to be all the more difficult. And even just being able to get people or hire people to be able to do contact tracing, and then also being able to get buy-in from the community, that there's still a large portion of the population that would not be willing to give up information about where they were. And of course, you know, it's much easier to do contract tracing in a place like New Zealand, which, you know, for many days or many weeks has only had 1, 2, 3 cases, or a place like Ireland, where certain areas like Waterford has only had, you know, 2 or 3 cases per day. The United States, the pandemic is just so, you know, the virus is spreading so much, contact tracing might be very difficult, if not impossible, in many locations to do.
Laurie Trommel Freeman with the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Has there been a problem trying to do contact tracing because of this hyper-political political atmosphere?
Yes, there have been sort of multiple issues with contact tracing. The politics have not helped. But initially, though, I will say that in order to have contact tracing be effective, there's a certain element of control that you have to have over the disease to begin with. If it's completely out of control and community spread is really surging, it becomes, you have to set contact tracing aside, and you have to focus on other things that will help you reach your goal of mitigating spread, like making sure testing turnaround is quick enough to allow contact tracing to take place. If you have 5 days in between the time of somebody taking a test and getting a result, and you've not isolated that person or quarantined them in any way, the virus just continues to spread out of control. On the politics side, the politics do not help contact tracing. If there's this fear of people giving up their freedoms, contact tracing is something that's going to be seen as another measure where the government's trying to exert control over who, whether you're isolating, quarantining, who your contacts are, you know, what's done with that information. But just to be clear, the bottom line is that information is purely collected to track the disease, not the person. And that information is rarely collected and kept beyond the point where somebody is through their quarantine or isolation period. It's purely for disease control. So,
but this lack of trust in the government doing the contact tracing, people fight against that and they claim it's a violation of their rights and they don't want to cooperate and they get very hostile when someone starts asking them these questions. It's the trust issue seems to be central to why this is breaking down. When a society is united and able to work well together and there's a lot of trust or at least some ability to work together, but when you have a society that's fractured like we are, then the COVID is able to really run rampant and take advantage of that, Lori.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, the funny thing is contact tracing has been used for just so many decades and over centuries even to spread common disease or even food outbreaks. So it's not meant to be threatening in any way. And in normal times outside a pandemic, somebody wouldn't even question whether or not they should give you where they ate their food that made them sick or who they were in contact with that gave them measles. So this is just hyper-politicized and really not necessary. And
it's counterproductive.
Really
it hurts public health. Let's go to Andrea on the phone. So Andrea, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Just a comment. I just want to say that I think the politicization of science and the public health recommendations related to COVID need to be seen in the broader context of Trump's election and presidency, which are largely predicated on a concerted effort to convince everyone that he's the only one to be believed and that everyone else, including the media and the scientists, are not to be trusted. And this is the pathway to authoritarianism, and unfortunately the result will be, as we are seeing now, escalating pandemic and death.
All right, Andrea, thank you for the call. Lauren Weber, a reporter for Kaiser Health News. People have been told, be on the lookout for sources of information that are self-sealing if they are saying, we are the only ones with the truth and everyone else is lying to you. Should that be a red flag that you're probably getting information from a tainted source?
That I believe that would be a red flag. And I think we go back to an earlier conversation we had in this program that both Lori brought up, which is that, you know, the difficult part about this pandemic has been that science in general, especially when you're dealing with a newfound disease like this, is changing, it's growing, it's evolving, and the data points are being solidified. And so when, you know, people, reporters, you know, officials, public health officials, even governors and presidents deal in the gray, nobody likes to deal in the gray. They like to deal in the absolutes. And I think that's led to a lot of the confusion, a lot of the pushback. But I think if people are unwilling to live in the gray with what is actually true and what they know and are only willing to deal in absolutes, you might you might be finding yourself in a bad source of info.
We're told just wait for the vaccine. The vaccine is going to come eventually, and then we'll be through this. But unfortunately, Lauren Weber, we're probably going to enter a new phase of politics and public health, because whoever thought that vaccines and politics would become a thing, right? But yeah, it is.
Yeah, no, it's unfortunate. But honestly, you know, we've seen so much anti-vax pushback, you know, in the last couple of years from measles, mumps, et cetera, that it's no surprise that for a vaccine for coronavirus, we're going to see a similar swell of disbelief and pushback, especially considering how fast this vaccine is being made. And, you know, a lot of public health workers and officials are really concerned that even if we do get a vaccine that, you know, much like the flu vaccine, it may not be, you know, 100% bulletproof. It has varying degrees of efficacy and safety, you know, safety in terms of protection, safety, you know, where it lessens the degree of the disease. It doesn't necessarily protect you all the way around. And that in itself could cause some issues when it comes to uptake for disease or for the vaccine going forward.
But this nationalism of the look for the search for a vaccine is disturbing. Why do we have countries competing against each other and cyber hacking each other, trying to get information? Why don't we have a global effort to try to find a vaccine and then have a global effort in order to distribute the vaccine? If the entire world doesn't have access to the vaccine, then this disease is not going to go away. It'll just mutate and become back even stronger. Christopher Kulasha at Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, are you disturbed by this nationalism of the vaccine approach?
Absolutely. And I think you make a very good point with that, that if we don't have some sort of coordination, you're right, we're just going to be seeing or potentially seeing this coming back and getting utterly worse. Unfortunately, though, it's not really that much of a surprise that this is what's happening, right? We are seeing, you know, a rise of populism and a rise of nationalism in many places, you know, within the United States, within Europe. But with that being said, states or just nations in general like to, you know, they look after themselves primarily versus anybody else. And they tend to make even things like this, where there's a very obvious benefit of working together, a bit of a competition, unfortunately. You know, this is sort of, you know, unfortunately, like a page right out of the playbook of realism.
And so we want to find a way to move things forward, improve public health outcomes. Lori Trumell Freeman, what are you telling or what are you hearing from your county and city health officials that can be encouraging?
Well, that we have an opportunity to turn the corner here. And, you know, our public health officials and the many people, professionals that work with them, are every bit as invested as the rest of the country in getting us all back to work, back to our lives. And in fact, when we have unrest and unemployment and financial stress and mental health stressors, these are all factors that contribute to more illness and more disparities and increased impacts to our communities, some of whom are already so vulnerable. So we need to kind of united front that we've seen, like, come forth after 9/11, when as a country we felt like if we could come together and be unified, and then we can get through anything, right? Mm-hmm. We need that kind of united effort as a country to come out of this and trust our science and data to pull us out of it.
And also recognize that the people who oppose this really are in the minority. Lori Trumell Freeman, thank you so much. National Association for County and City Health Officials. Also with us, Christopher Kulasha at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. Lauren Weber at Kaiser Health News. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.